This is the place, and this is the time. Here and now, the mystery awaits to break into our experience, to change our minds, to change our lives, to change our ways, to help us see the world and the whole of life in a new light. This is the place. This is the time. Here and now, let us praise the mystery by joining together in song. At the center of our service and at the center of our lives, we take this time to light candles of memory, candles of hope, or because we feel troubled, blessed, conflicted, or simply because we'd like to add a little light to the world. Please join me in an attitude of prayer. Mystery of many names and mystery beyond all naming. We sit here today at the very beginning of a new year. Whether you believe in cyclical time or the linear version, today is a new beginning for all of us. Perhaps it's time to set down our burdens and examine them. With the weight off our shoulders, let's take a good look at these indispensables that we've carted with us for these umpteen years. George Carlin once said that wherever we go, we need to take a little of our stuff with us. Are the burdens you've been carrying around just too large to be considered a little of your stuff? That argument you had last year, you know the one I'm talking about, the one you never resolved, the one that still gets replayed every morning when you wake up. Perhaps it's time to bury the hatchet, call that person up and tell them you just want to restore the friendship to its former luster. I'm thinking now of those rooms at the various concentration camps during the Holocaust. Those rooms filled with the detritus of a hurried exit. Those rooms filled with things that had no life in and of themselves. Holocaust means a whole burning. Maybe it's time to burn all the burdens we've been carrying all these years. Ask yourself this question. Who am I? Who would I be without these burdens? You might be surprised to find yourself facing a new you in a new year. It's time to rub the slate of resentments clean. In 100 years, who will know the score you're keeping? Better to wipe off that slate and use it for a grocery list. At least that would feed you. And now let us all promise to honor our feelings this coming year, to honor our pain, to honor our anger, to honor our love and joy, to honor all the feelings that come our way, and stop imagining that we can control any of this thing that we call life. Make us all non-anxious presences in life. Create in us the loving space to simply watch and not judge. Prepare us to meet life on its own terms, remembering that how we think things should be and how things really are seldom line up together. In the name of everything that is holy and that is precisely everything, amen.
My name is Carolyn Grimminger, and I've been a member of this church for about 3.5 years. I believe it is possible to learn how to forgive. I think one of the most important tasks that I can learn is how to forgive others, ranging from small unintentional slights to intentional woundings. I've been intending on writing this affirmation of faith for about a year. I ran into some difficulty in mental and emotional roadblocks. I seemed to get stuck on what I came to find was my grievance story. My intention is for this information to be helpful to myself and to others. I realize my need to forgive. I know that when I don't forgive, it cuts off my ability to enjoy life. Also, I have experienced that when I don't forgive, it tends to keep me connected to the hurting party in a way that disempowers me. I really want to enjoy my life and enter into it fully. I would like for you to be able to do the same. I tried to get unstuck in my lack of forgiveness by first talking with friends to see if they knew anything about forgiveness. It was both comforting and somewhat dismaying to find out that others do not know much about forgiveness either. For some reason, I thought it would come more naturally. I've been working in the addiction field, both as a counselor and an adult probation officer, for about 12 years. I have become intimately acquainted with the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Addicts and alcoholics have the blessing of a program that seems to focus and provide a way to forgive both self and others. I came to see that I needed some of my own resources to that effect. I came to realize that one can learn forgiveness skills that might not be that innately apparent. One resource that I found is the book Forgive for Good by Dr. Fred Luskin. I recommend it to you wholeheartedly if, like me, you have found it hard to forgive either yourself or others, or maybe even both. My forgiveness journey has led me to realize that one of the reasons I have gotten stuck in a lack of forgiveness is that I've allowed those who have hurt me to become the center of my awareness. Dr. Luskin recommends that one way to become unstuck and to learn how to forgive is to change your grievance story. The grievance story is the story we tell ourselves and others about how we were hurt in the past. If we keep telling ourselves that story over and over, that story tends to stay our reality and to disempower us. It is important to reframe our grievance story from a tale of helplessness and blame to personal empowerment and healing. When we become the hero instead of the victim in our life, my belief today is that I can learn from every experience and to become a better person. We can allow hurts to soften us and open our hearts and minds to compassion and to realize our connectedness to others, instead of hardening into resentment that cuts us off from the best parts of ourselves and of life. Instead of having unenforceable rules that demand that people treat me in a certain way, I can connect with my positive intentions in life so that circumstances that have wounded me in the past no longer take center stage, but they become part of the larger picture of life. To forgive means that we develop the ability to live life without taking offense, to stop blaming others for how we feel, and to tell stories that reflect peace and understanding. We can have hopes for certain circumstances in our lives. We can at the same time remember that many times things do not work out the way we'd hoped for. To me, it's a matter of faith that I can continue to have personal hopes for happiness and peace in the face of the uncertainties of life. We can heal and create the best lives possible for ourselves, the people we love, and the communities in which we live by reconnecting with our positive intentions and letting go of our grievance story. Thank you.
One of the things that's wrong in the program is the name of the sermon. It's really not "Forgive Me for Not Talking." If that was the name of the sermon, my name would be Marcel Marceau, and I would be fighting against an imaginary wind. The name of the sermon is really "Forgive Me for Not Talking About Forgiveness." For now, a musical interlude. Frankie and Johnny were lovers. Lordy, oh, how they could love. They swore to be true to each other, as true as the stars above. He was her man, but he done her wrong. When I was a bad boy, when I was acting out in my alcoholic years, I did lots of people wrong. And since I was a blackout drinker, I had to put up with
the fact that most of the things I did, I didn't remember. That's always a lot of fun. Your nightly activities are related to you by people you've insulted, harassed, and otherwise abused. You get used to saying, "I'm sorry, I really don't remember that," or "I can't believe I said, did, or acted in that matter, and I sincerely hope you know it has everything to do with my drinking and nothing to do with you." Whatever. You get to say, "I'm sorry," a lot, and you know what? People are generally willing to say they forgive you. Now, the forgiveness factor is directly related to how long you've known somebody. If it's an old friend, a close relative, a spouse, a brother, or a sister, then the forgiveness font is fairly plentiful. You can bathe there night and day if you wish, if you can stand the looks of disgust on their faces as they say they forgive you, if you can bring yourself to face one more time that spouse who says, "I forgive you, but I'll never forget." Yeah, pretty soon you're dreaming of that day when she'll have Alzheimer's. And I became so full of forgiveness, and I don't mean that I was forgiving a lot of people. I was just so full of forgiveness, I just couldn't take any more forgiveness. Forgiveness was beginning to look like a cheap suit on me. And that freely associates, I think, to Dietrich Bonhoeffer's idea of cheap grace. And that's what cheap forgiveness feels like. After you've been forgiven umpteen times, you began to feel like you've just got a whole bunch of cheap grace, and it doesn't mean anything. You've gotten away with murder just one more time. In the book of Luke, Jesus is reported to have said, "Father, forgive them. They know not what they do." Now, he supposedly says this from the cross. He's nailed up there, so the weight of his body will be on his arms entirely, so he'll suffocate. His feet are nailed to a support, so his knees are always bent, and he can't stand up. Slowly, he'll suffocate. In that pain, Jesus is reported to have said, "Father, forgive them. They know not what they do." Now, Luke is one of the later Gospels. There's a lot of traditions and additions blended in with the good doctor's book. The earliest Gospel, Mark, written before Luke, says this. It says that on the cross, Jesus only said one thing. "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani." That's Aramaic for, my God, why have you forsaken me?" So, which story do you buy? In Luke, Jesus forgives his murderers as he's being murdered. And there we have Mark, the voice of anger, rage, resentment, and hurt. My thesis for today is fairly simple. If you think forgiveness is a big problem, you're right, but probably not for the right reasons. You see, forgiveness is a symptom. The real problem is anger. Because we can't forgive someone without first being angry with them, and many of us just don't want to own our anger. Traditionally, anger is considered to be one of the seven deadly sins, remembering that sin is nothing more than separation from God, separation from your true self. Can anybody here remember those seven deadlies? I had to look it up. Pride, envy, anger, avarice, sadness, gluttony, and lust. The American Buddhist Philip Kaplow has this to say: "Anger is the means of staving off the fear of the isolation of death." In other words, the solitariness of death scares the bejesus out of us, and that fear inspires anger. In psychological circles, it's believed that anger, pure anger, never really happens, that anger is a cluster emotion, secondary to and combined with fear and threat. The reason we have trouble forgiving is we've not allowed ourselves the luxury of our anger. Now, acting out your anger can kill other people. Stuffing your anger can kill you. We seem to be caught between a rock and a hard place. If the source of anger is threat or fear, then we must understand what threatens us. What are we truly afraid of? It's rather human-like to defend yourself when you're being threatened. Recently, a president of a prominent democratic nation has built his entire regime around being threatened. My friend, the Buddhist monk Claude Anshin Thomas, who was also a Vietnam veteran, said that after 9/11, we had an enormous chance to turn the Dharma wheel. Now, turning the Dharma wheel in Buddhist culture is a good thing. It's like teaching peace. The world post 9/11, they was on our side. They were reaching out to us. What would have happened if, when we flew over Afghanistan, we dropped, instead of bombs, food, medicine, supplies? What if the better angels of our nature had responded? In her Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Gilead, Marilynne Robinson has the old dying preacher writing a letter to his 7-year-old son. In part of the letter, he says, "I would advise you against defensiveness on principle. It precludes the best eventualities along with the worst. At the most basic level, it expresses a lack of faith. As I've said, the worst eventualities can have great value as experience. And often enough, when we think we are protecting ourselves, we are, in fact, struggling against our rescuer." Another problem. How do we look at Osama bin Laden as a rescuer? Perhaps the heart of this problem surfaces when we get away from the world of morality and enter the world of aesthetics. John Calvin, the preeminent 16th century Reformed theologian, says that each one of us is an actor on God's stage and that God is our audience. This gets at the point in a more convenient and expedient manner, I believe. For if our actions are not judged morally by those who surround us and go to make up our lives, but rather they are to be judged as performances, then we can get closer to the problem. Now, when you see a play and somebody does a bad job, do you ever go up afterward and forgive them for their performance? When somebody points to a painting they just spent $30,000 for and it's really awful, do you feel like getting in touch with the painter and saying you forgive them? When's the last time you heard someone play the violin like they were torturing a cat? Did you promptly run up and offer them your forgiveness? When an actor has a bad performance, they're encouraged not to dwell in it. You just stay in the moment. It's just like athletes. And the next time the curtain goes up, you begin again. You start over as if it were the first time you'd ever said those lines in your life. Joel Gregory, who used to be the pastor at First Baptist Church in Dallas, Texas, calls this beginning again the final stage of forgiveness. Imagine you've got a daughter or son that you've disowned, and you tell them one day, I'd like to be your dad again. I'd like for you to be my daughter or son again. Or say you've got an old friend that you've fallen out with. You'd say to that old friend, "Hey, let's start over. Let's be friends again." Okay, sure, you run the risk of being rebuffed, but is that any worse than waking up every morning with those tapes of resentment running through your heart and mind? Starting over again would be akin to starting a new chapter in the story of your friendship, a new chapter in the narrative of what it might be like for you to be a father and for them to be a son or daughter. We all tell ourselves stories. That's how we make sense of our lives. We do it from childhood to old age. These stories are sometimes known as core narratives. They're no more or less true than the story of Jesus itself. The stories we tell ourselves are there to keep us in a comfort zone. Whatever makes us happy or strokes us, that's in the story. Whatever makes us uncomfortable, we write it out of the story, unless, of course, it keeps making us uncomfortable and we can't get away from it. Then we incorporate it into the story. To forgive, one must first realize what scared us to being angry, what's pushed us out of our comfort zone. Reality has a way of not cooperating with your comfort zone. Have you noticed that? If you're angry a lot, feel powerless to forgive those who have dumped upon your dreams, then the stories you're telling yourself might sound like this. This isn't fair. I'm a good person. Things like this don't happen to good people. Where's the justice in what's happened to me? You see, the problem doesn't lie in the events themselves. In reality, the problem lies in your interpretation of the events. How well have you or have you not included these threatening events in your core narrative? For in the end, the only thing that really counts is your interpretation. Feeling anxious, angry, unforgiving, it's time to rewrite your core narrative. Do you remember the way you felt when the Beatles went from the loving mopeds of Rubber Soul to the freaks of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band? The Beatles had met the Maharishi. They'd gone to India. George had taken sitar lessons, and oh, yeah, they had also dropped acid. Their psychological experiences caused them to rewrite, refigure, reformat, reinvent the Beatles, who they were. And if you love them because, as John said, they were more popular than Jesus Christ himself in his day, or if you love them in spite of that statement, then you, who could have been threatened, who could have been offended, you change too. As a matter of fact, we help the Beatles rewrite their core narratives. And of course, it didn't hurt if you'd also dropped acid. Can't forgive someone for the way they've done you, how they've abused you, discarded you, betrayed you. Rewrite your story. Put their actions in perspective. Deal with them, their actions, your reactions. De-triangulate yourself. Redefine yourself so that your understanding of grace and justice isn't so narrowly construed. Try to remember, if you've allowed someone to stomp on your dream, guess who let them into your dream in the first place? It helps to, again, give that person as much credit as you can for being a good and worthy human being. And don't forget, the minute community is posited, the second you have an alliance, a love, or a relationship, you've automatically given that other person the trump card of betrayal. People act out from their fears, threats, and hurts. Can we ever really know why someone betrays us? Perhaps it would be good to think about a time in your life when you played the trump card of betrayal on someone else. So let go of that story that hurts you. Rewrite a story that heals and blesses you. Friedrich Nietzsche once said, "That which does not kill me makes me stronger." If we are to survive, we must optimize the opportunities and possibilities for survival. And it's not as simple as either you see the glass half empty or half full. No. Look, you've told yourself the same stories year after year after year. Are you happy yet? Do you still have fear? Do you still feel threatened? You've got to expand your repertoire. Write some new material, for God's sake. If you were comedians, you'd be booed off the stage. Again, Marilynne Robinson, in her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Gilead, suggests that looking at our relationship with God, a la John Calvin, as if we were a performer and God is the audience, might give us a clue on how God could enjoy us. In other words, God isn't passing out morality judgments. The book of life isn't full of black marks. It's full of bad reviews. And what's the difference, you might ask? Glad you asked that. You can't learn anything from a bad review, from a moral judgment. All you can learn that is, in fact, you're wrong. But from a bad review, the possibilities are endless. In 1981, when I had my first play, The Valley of the Shadow, done in Tallahassee, Florida, at Tommy's Deep South Music Hall, the reviewer for the Tallahassee Democrat, John Hobbick, he raked me over the coals. In part of the review, the nicer part, he said that my play had more tragic flaws than the Iliad and the Odyssey combined. Now, did I cry over that review? No. I called up the Democrat. I got John Hobbick on the phone. I had a meeting with him, and I learned more about how to write a play. What if we'd been taught that God was like a life coach, that God was on our side, and somewhere along the way, she had suggested ways in which you could, enhance your performance? But what if you feel that you're literally caught in a hellish situation? What if, like this play, what do we do with a world that causes children to race into minefields just so they can fill their stomachs? Concentration camp survival literature consistently shows that even in that environment, even in that hell, how the people reacted, responded to that horrific environment made all the difference in the world. You got to look for the cracks in the door of fate. You're the salesman of your life. When you see a crack in that door, you stick your foot in there. You sing, you dance, you do whatever it takes. In conclusion, I'd like to offer you a formula for forgiveness, an easy way for you to know how to deal with your anger, whom to forgive, and how to forgive them. Get your pens and pencils out. Unfortunately, no such formula exists. Like much of life, the manner in which we deal with our anger at people, situations, and even inanimate objects brings a great deal to bear on the people who could benefit from our forgiveness, never forgetting that we are one of those people. This is what I want to reiterate. I want to reiterate that you are the dealer in your life. I want to remind you as the dealer that you can reshuffle the deck anytime you want and start a new deal. You need to keep in mind that no matter how many times you shuffle the deck, no matter how many times you shuffle that deck, once you're in a relationship, once you're in community, once you're in any sort of intimate situation, the card on the top of the deck, the one you're about to deal out, is always the trump card of betrayal. It's sort of like a card trick, but it turns out the trick may be on you. If you simply don't want to deal with others, then you can play solitaire. Yeah, lots of people have done it. Some have actually won the game. Zen masters, religious mystics of every order come to mind. But I want to warn you, there's a danger in playing solitaire. You just might deal yourself the trump card of betrayal. State institutions are full of people who have dealt themselves this card, and I can only conjecture that suicides are holding this card in their hand years before they actually play it. 45 years ago, Dr. Rachel Naomi Raymond had a patient who got lost in a snowstorm on a skiing trip. When they found him, both of his feet were badly frostbitten. The doctor suggested amputation of both feet. He waited for a world-class vascular surgeon to show up. The man showed up, did some things, and his left foot got better, but his right foot took a turn for the worse. He refused amputation. Finally, when the foot was so black and the poison was circling through his system, the doctors, the world-class vascular surgeon, and his fiance went into his room and begged him to have that foot cut off. Again, he refused. Angry and sobbing in her anger, his fiance took the brilliant diamond ring off her finger and plunged it onto the little black toe of his right foot, and she said, "I hate this damn foot. You want this foot so damn much, why don't you marry it?" He got the foot amputated. They're still married. There's a parallel between our resentments, our betrayals, our inability to forgive, and to get on with life. There's a parallel between those things and a gangrenous foot. I think the question boils down to this. What are you married to? The baggage of your life or life itself?